morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockhorizon.com. On today's panel, we have Chief Investment Strategist John Portwood, and Investment Directors Greg Hudleski, Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tangus, and serving as our moderators, our Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our monthly economic update call. John, we'll start with you. Last week, we had the first print of the second quarter GDP. That number came in at 2.6%, pretty much in line with, I think, what a lot of economists or strategists expected. I was thinking about the number, and I guess we're in interesting times where you get an economic growth in the reading of 2.6%, and you say, wow, what a great quarter. I guess it just sort of gives you an idea of the times that we've been in. If you could talk a little bit about the quarter, maybe dissect that number and then give us some outlook onto, we're a month into the third quarter, obviously, how things look for the remainder of the year. John?
Okay. The long-term trends haven't changed a great deal, as you might imagine, with a quarter at 2.6%. It's pretty much what everybody expected, certainly within the range of consensus as the quarter ended. The good thing about the quarter was that consumer spending picked up for the first time in a month or two, since the last quarter. It was better than it was at the end of the last quarter. So that was certainly good news. The thing that's a little bit disturbing about that, well, not disturbing, but it sort of, balances out the fact that consumer spending increased. Annual per capita disposable income dropped. And the savings rate reportedly dropped by about a tenth of a percent, but that's still down from where it was the prior quarter. So it looks like the consumers are spending money, but it looks like the consumer debt levels might have gone up at the same time. So that's a little bit of a worry about consumer spending growth going forward. But basically, it was a pretty decent quarter. Certainly, there was nothing there that you could point to and say, the future looks bleak. The leading indicators are still positive. They're softer than they were, indicating that we could be passing through a softer period in the next quarter or so than we have experienced, in the last 3 months. But the overall year looks okay. 2% plus or minus, I guess, seems to be a reasonable assumption. Going forward, a lot of people are assuming 2 to 3% growth rates. If you look at a lot of economic calculations that are factored into estimates for stock valuations and various and sundry other things for the next 3 to 5 years, it seems that somewhere in that 2.5% range, all of these estimates are being are settling out, and that's sort of being used as a baseline. That may or may not come true, of course. We don't really know looking that far ahead, but it seems to be a reasonable assumption given where we are. But when you think of where we are and the fact that 10-year GDP growth annualized is only about real GDP growth, is only about 1.4%. That really hasn't changed a lot. We've talked about that before. Historically, you could look at a lot of 10-year periods and see 3%. And we're only at 1.4. Per capita GDP is running less than 1% over the last 10 years annualized, and normally that's been closer to about 2%. And when you look at per capita GDP, it gives you some idea of what's happened to the standard of living and what's being felt at the Main Street level, so to speak. And those numbers, of course, are there because of what happened in 2007 and 2008, and we just haven't picked up any steam since then. And that's kind of where we are. But the interesting thing about this, and we've talked about 2% growth for a long time, the fact that we're probably going to muddle through, it's going to be low inflation, low interest rates for a very long period of time, and the Fed will stay easy for a very long period of time, and so forth and so on. And now it appears the Fed would like to begin to normalize rates a little bit and normalize their quantitative easing, or at least reduce their QE. Meanwhile, in Europe and Japan, they're still kind of pushing ahead with it. But in any case, you kind of wonder what's going to happen going forward. Is it going to be ice, like a lot of people have suggested, where it's a cooler economy, everything is cooler. Again, like I said, low interest rates, low inflation, low PE growth, I mean, not low PE growth, but low earnings growth, and so forth and so on. Then others think we might end up with something that's a little hotter, fire instead of ice, where you end up with a situation with the administration in power at the time, the governmental authorities. They look at the growth rates. They don't see anything very exciting. They decide to begin a massive fiscal stimulus program of some sort at the same time that a new Fed under a new Fed chairman begins to employ something that might be the equivalent of helicopter money drops, where you really engage in a lot of radical monetary policy to get us off the dime, get us out of this 2% growth rate, and get us into something a little bit stronger. You just don't know. I mean, if that happens in an inflationary environment like that, your investment position is going to change. A lot of things are going to change as far as what you do with your money and how things are handled. So it's something to keep in the back of our minds, I guess. It's not on the horizon, but it's being talked about a little bit more, I think, simply because everybody is now on the side of low growth and low inflation forever. So, you know, we'll just have to see how that works out. So that's kind of where we are, Dave. It's a reasonably decent economic period. The underlying factors are not particularly strong, and yet we don't see a recession on the horizon. So it looks like we're just steaming ahead like we were in the past.
Okay. We couldn't have this call without talking about healthcare, unfortunately. As I'm assuming most on the call are aware, just pure dysfunction in Washington. The Senate, after numerous attempts, was unable to pass any sort of bill to bring to conference with the House to move forward some legislation as it regards health care. And I think we're in kind of a tough spot now, John, in terms of, you know, there's a lot of difficulties going on with the exchanges and insurance programs as it stands today with no clear direction. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. Where do we go from here?
Well, worse before better sounds like a good bet. We hate to talk about things like that. But unfortunately, once you give somebody something, it's hard to take it back. And the government has provided some extra entitlements in the Affordable Care Act that currently exists. Nobody wants to take any of that away, and nobody can figure out at this point how to modify or restructure the program to make it more, maybe cost effective isn't the right word to use, but to make it more efficient, I guess, and less costly. There's probably no way to do that, no way at all. You can't cut the insurance companies out of the picture. They're getting a big subsidy. If that stops, everything falls apart. There doesn't seem to be any real impetus behind changing the structure of medical care in the country in a very, very big way. And it looks like we're sort of stuck where we are, and something will eventually be decided upon. As we all know, it's a moving target. Something new and different comes out almost every day about what somebody believes or what they're going to vote for or how the system is going to be designed. In any case, I think the only thing all of us can really count on is that healthcare costs are going up. Somebody's going to pay more for what they get, and it will eventually settle on some sort of plan, I suppose. But as far as all of us are concerned in terms of medical costs, I think they're going up, and the system is probably not going to be organized any better for a while. It's kind of a bleak prospect, I guess, but that looks like that's the way it is.
Okay. And I think, from a legislative agenda standpoint, I think the plan all along was to tackle health care first, then move on to tax reform. And based on what I've read, it appears that there's a pivot being made, that maybe they're giving up on health care and now we're going to begin to focus on tax reform. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
If you could maybe talk a little bit about the plan now as it regards tax reform, and is my opening remarks or assumptions that they're basically moving on accurate?
It seems that way. I think there is a limited timetable here in this fiscal year in this administration, and the clock is running. The Congress is obviously recessing and will come back in September, where things really need to kind of get rolling at that point if anything's going to get accomplished in this fiscal year, which ends at the end of October. So there was a meeting among six leaders, a couple of administration officials, don't have all the names handy, and several congressional leaders such as Ryan and McConnell, talking to work on tax reform, and they issued a statement last week. And as has been the case before, the statement was light on details and left a number of questions unanswered, which is sort of not very confidence inspiring. But I'd like to just kind of go through a few things that are good to know from this statement, some of which really wasn't reported very very well in the news media. So there was like five or six things here that are worth knowing. First of all, and this is pretty amazing, really, based on what I think investors and consumers thought, there was actually no specific mention of cutting tax rates, the percentages for individuals, as it was for corporations in the statements. So obviously there are ways to cut taxes without cutting rates, but many people had made the assumption that tax rates would be collapsed. Maybe some of the higher rates would be reduced. Maybe proportionally they'd be reduced across the board. But there was actually a obvious avoidance of using a term tax rate reduction. There were terms used such as make taxes lower, and that allowing ordinary Americans to keep more of their hard-earned money, which are great statements, but there was definitely an avoidance of the term tax rate reduction, and that term was used in the context of corporate taxes. So I think that's pretty important. Instead, it looks like from the statement that there may be an emphasis on other ways of reducing individuals' taxes, such as perhaps increasing or even doubling the standard deduction, which many people in the middle income area use, since they typically don't get to itemize their deductions. If the standard deduction was increased, that would have a pretty big effect on, would create a middle class tax cut and would not really have much effect at the upper income levels. And I think that's something to keep in mind about where the direction of this plan may go. The second item is there was absolutely no mention of the estate tax at all. We've heard previous comments early on about, eliminating the death tax or things of that nature, which has been attempted many times and only successfully dealt with a few times over the past several decades, but it was absolutely not mentioned. And a conclusion that you might draw from that is this administration, and again, combine this with the prior statement I just made, is this administration may want to be protecting itself from any criticism for cutting taxes on the wealthy. So I think that omission of the mention of the estate tax could be an insightful thing to keep in mind for future plans. The third item in the statement was it made a statement about this plan would have unprecedented capital expensing, or allowing corporations to do more expensing of their capital improvements, which is a pro-growth, pro-productivity type of move. What's interesting about that is that it's generally believed that some of the administration officials, including President Trump and Steve Mnuchin and Mr. Kahn, are not real fans of capital expensing as an economic tool, yet it was prominently mentioned in this statement. So there seems to be enough push there to get to get that mentioned. So it may very well be a part of the final plan. Fourth, it's not clear at all from this statement whether these six leaders who met have any intention of having a net tax cut, though it was sort of suggested with a statement that said something like that we want tax relief for American families, and that should be at the heart of our plan. Sort of a reference to it, but not specific. So, and another statement said, this plan will place a priority on permanence. As you may remember from comments made last month and earlier comments on these calls, if you don't get a revenue-neutral plan, then it sunsets in 10 years and you have to go back and redo it, pass another law. And there is obviously an emphasis on trying to get something in place that is permanent. But as I said last month, there are some loopholes available, such as dynamic scoring and altering the revenue baseline, which can actually accomplish a permanent tax cut and still get a net tax cut. But it's still interesting that it wasn't mentioned in the statement. And it could be that they're just holding that close to the vest and really don't want to come out with it. I think we'll hear more about this later, but it's a little frustrating that it did not come out and promote the idea of a net tax cut specifically. Fifth, it was completely silent on the issue of tax reform. Tax cuts were mentioned, particularly for corporations, but the reform, which would involve things such as broadening the tax base to make the tax base obviously affect more people, to broaden it out and not make it so progressive, was not mentioned. And that's a pretty noticeable omission as well. Again, the White House may seem to have misgivings about that. Maybe this progressive tax system we've got now may be something that they are afraid to get away from, again, because of potential criticism of helping the wealthy at the expense of the middle classes. And finally, the statement doesn't really address the issue of how the playing field will be leveled between U.S. corporations and foreign companies, which is the problem we've had now with companies, hoarding cash overseas, not willing to repatriate it because of the onerous tax situation here, as well as the corporate inversions where U.S. corporations want to go incorporate in countries like the Netherlands, for example, and therefore get a tax break by doing that. So it's not mentioned in here how that playing field will be leveled. Will it be some kind of a territorial tax system that favors, U.S. produced income and taxes foreign income or what? So again, another question mark. So in conclusion here, the statement doesn't really answer some of the major questions that are out there about revenue neutrality, about tax cuts on a net basis, whether the tax base will be broadened or whether the code will be reformed. So when Congress comes back in September, they'll basically be at square one, kind of where they were when we started, with no real plan. The committees don't have enough direction at this point to start writing a bill. So it's quite discouraging. That would be my conclusion. It's pretty discouraging, but hopefully all is not lost. It's still in the first year of this administration.
Well, let me put you on the spot a little bit, Richard. I'm going to ask you some questions and just try and keep the answers pretty short.
Sure.
What do you think? Instead, I won't put you on the spot on a yes, no, but what are the odds, if you had to put odds on passage of some sort of tax reform?
This year?
This year or next year, but either. Tax reform.
I would still say, I'd say 70% in favor of something getting passed in this calendar year would be my...
Do you think this calendar year is still a possibility?
Yeah, I just don't think it may be somewhat disappointing of a bill in terms of the size, but I think it'll be a net tax cut of some size, and it'll be passed this year.
And you definitely think it's going to favor businesses over individuals, it sounds like.
I think it'll be good for businesses and not so positive for the general public, but it will definitely favor more the middle class and maybe nothing for the upper income levels.
Okay. Well, obviously important policy that has a lot of implications both for individuals and businesses and markets. So I suspect that we'll be talking about that in the months to come. Thank you for your comments, Richard.
Thank you.
Yesterday when we were kind of outlining what we're going to talk about, Jeff Tangus mentioned that, you know, there seems to be, you know, there's always international issues that we're dealing with, but there seems to be more hot spots than ever right now. And usually the Middle East is the central point, a lot of turmoil, but it's definitely more widespread. We could do a lot of discussion around each one of these, but Venezuela, you have Nicolas Maduro and his power grab and basically a country that's in constitutional crisis, possibly moving to a dictatorship. You have all of the controversy and sanctions surrounding Russia and their election meddling. And then North Korea, consistently, and it seems to be moving further along in their nuclear ambitions, continually to flex their muscles with a lot of missile launch and a lot of talk to accompany it. Jeff, what do you think is going on in regards to all of these particular issues?
Well, I can't help, in reading all the news headlines every day, I can't help but get a sense that certainly the global communist bloc, and I'll add Iran to that that list that you just ran through, and China, I think there's a perceived distraction in Washington, and there is an ongoing effort globally by a lot of the countries I won't necessarily call them adversaries, but certainly not allies, to challenge the U.S. economic and, to some degree, our military might, or at least our will to engage. Certainly Trump has come out, and while on occasion, certainly in Syria, dropping the mother of all bombs and a couple of occasions like that, outside of that, Trump has been pretty clear that he's not the type of guy who's a big believer in engaging in conflicts around the world. And I think I think the U.S. is being challenged. Certainly, like you cited, the dictator in Venezuela has the would-be dictator Maduro in Venezuela has kind of thumbed his nose at Trump and the U.S. and said, you know, I don't care what you do, I'm going to go ahead with my plan to consolidate power. So you had that. You have Russia, which, Russia is always sort of challenging the U.S. In the skies, especially around Alaska, but it seems to be a lot more common. I think there were four engagements in 4 days, which is a lot more than we historically see, where they were running bombers and fighters really close to the international lines, and we had to scramble jets out to intercept. I think, again, that's saber-rattling by Russia. North Korea, we don't even need to talk about that. Everybody knows what's going on in North Korea as they continue to thumb their nose at the U.S. And then in China, we see China continuing to try to build on their international clout as they try to dominate the South China Sea, much to the rest of the international law and Japan and our allies in the area. We've had an engagement there, our Navy versus theirs. Again, it was sort of a cat and mouse thing, but they're not hesitant to go out there, fly bombers over the South China Sea and sort of flex their muscle there. And then finally, Iran. Recently, there was an engagement in the Persian Gulf where we basically had to fire warning shots. We tried to warn off an Iran warship that was approaching. We gave them several verbal warnings to turn around, and they would not do it. Finally, we had to fire missiles in their direction. to make them turn around. So I just I can't help but notice that as Washington seems to be preoccupied with a lot of these other things outside our borders, other nations are trying to build on their international clout. Why is that important? Well, certainly it impacts our ability to influence global affairs. Our allies are watching to see how engaged we are, if we're going to be a reliable ally, if we're going to defend militarily our allies' interests around the world. I think it it also impacts our ability to influence economics, trade negotiations, and things of that sort, given our influence internationally. So while this isn't this, it's not a hard factor that you can really pin down and quantify. It does go to the America's influence. Clearly, we still have lots of influence. Nobody can challenge us militarily. It's just our will to do so. So, you know, in the midst of all that, we've seen, I guess, since around February of this year, for a lot of reasons, not necessarily this alone, but I think this is a part of it, probably a minor part. We've seen the U.S. dollar decline about 10% as, and this is all since the Trump inauguration. I think, again, that dollar decline is related to a lot of what's going on in Washington and the distraction that's taking place there. So I keep an eye on that sort of thing. I think that it's a big issue in the long run, not necessarily has a big impact what's happening next week, but our ability to influence international affairs is definitely what hangs in the balance there, Dave.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jeff. Greg, wow, you've heard Jeff talk about a lot of the international strife and dysfunction in Washington, and yet another good month for stocks. They seem, you know, the stock market seems to be unfazed. We continue to hit all-time highs, it seems like, every month for the major market averages. July, really, really good for international. The international or ACWI, All Country World Index, XUF, was up 3.7%, really strong number there. S&P 500 up 2.1%. And then the Russell 2000, modestly positive at 0.7%. Why does the market continue to shake off all of these events that you think could spook the market some? And, you know, maybe give us a little bit insight into where you think we're going for the remainder of the year.
Yeah, I've got a few ideas on that. And generally, yes, the veil of uncertainty or whatever you want to call it does spook markets. While we've been on the call, I actually got some of the S&P numbers just to add a little more color. That trend that we've been talking about throughout the year so far of large caps outperforming, mid caps outperforming, small caps is really somewhat intact. As you said, the S&P was up about 2%, but the mid-caps were up about 0.88 and the small-caps up 0.97, so kind of inching them out. But if you look at those numbers year-to-date, large-caps are only up about 1.59, and mid-caps all of a sudden are the star year-to-date at 6.92, and then small-caps 3.79. I'm not exactly sure what to make of that just yet, but certainly that trend that we, as I said, we had at the beginning of the year has fallen by the wayside. Just looking at value and growth, growth continues to be super strong relative to value. The month return for growth was 2.6% for the S&P Growth Index, and value was up 1.37. Year-to-date, growth is still 16.29 versus 6.29, so you've got a huge spread between value and growth stocks. And I kind of attribute that probably to people expecting slower economy, and so they're willing to pay up for the growth. But again, let's move on to just earnings season. You know, we're well into earnings season. We're looking at two consecutive quarters now of double-digit profit growth. This is about the first time in years, I think, since probably around 2011. About 58 to 60% of the S&P 500 companies have reported second quarter earnings so far. And the main drivers of this, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal, are years of cost cutting, weaker dollar, and better consumer spending. So, you know, a better outlook by the consumer, and John alluded to that too. As it stands right now, we're looking at 11% profit growth for the S&P 500 companies in the second quarter. 72% of the companies that have reported have beat analyst estimates. So, you know, that's pretty good also. Now, of course, after the first quarter, we saw a lot of estimates being guided down, but this follows a 15% growth rate for the first quarter of 2017. So, you know, the earnings growth that we're seeing so far this year is really better than I think anyone expected at the start of 2017. And again, although the second quarter is down slightly, that was somewhat to be expected. Again, for those of you that listen to this call monthly, we said that companies were guiding estimates down slightly after the first quarter's reporting season in terms of anticipation of a slowdown in economic activity in the second quarter. But one point, and this kind of addresses what you were saying, is why the market keeps going up. I think the July equity performance highlights something that we've been saying for quite some time about how stocks really respond to the economy and not so much to politics. Many pundits attributed the continual rise in markets to Trump's policy initiatives of lower taxes, decreased regulation, investments in infrastructure. We're now entering the month of August, and really none of the promises have materialized because of the usual partisan infighting in Washington. Regardless of that fact, the markets continue to make new highs, and again, markets have their eye on the economics and not the constant distraction of politics. And I think, again, investors just in general place far too much weight on the political climate. And I'm not trying to dismiss that politics or Washington doesn't have some influence through policy initiatives on how the markets operate. But again, markets seem to find a way. They're going to work with whatever they have to and whatever framework has been imposed upon them. Just looking at sector performance, and these are the Russell 1000 sectors, telecom had the best performance, coming in at about 6%, followed by technology, which returned over 4%, and next by utilities, returning over 2%. None of the sectors were negative for the month of July, so that was, again, a pretty positive thing to happen. Generally, there's some positives and negatives, but all the sectors were up, so it was a very good July for typically what they call the dog days of summer. The three worst performing sectors were healthcare at 0.6%, followed by consumer staples at 0.6%, and finally industrials at 0.2%. Back to just valuations, you know, given the great earnings that we've had, again, that PE ratio we've talked about, that markets are, you know, kind of richly valued, and valuations still remain on the lofty side. And again, in the context, though, of a low interest rate environment, that's not necessarily unusual. The big question is, will earnings growth be strong enough to bring PE ratios down? Probably not. That's going to require some kind of a sell-off in stocks to bring prices down. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a market crash. It doesn't mean a bear market. It just means a correction. And it wouldn't be unusual, again, if you have markets going up day in, day out, that you have some kind of pullback, and eventually perhaps one of the geopolitical events will just all of a sudden somebody will say, well, this really does matter, and then stocks will sell off. But as long as markets continue to climb on better expectations and earnings continue to grow alongside rising markets, it's hard to foresee really any major reductions in valuation without some type of correction. But I think, again, the general attitude, and whether you want to attribute, you know, some of it probably is attributed to better consumer confidence. I think there's going to be some kind of an inflection point where the investing public says, you know, the Trump administration is not accomplishing anything, and perhaps that may put a damper on some of the consumer confidence or just sentiment in general. But right now, it seems like things are kind of clicking along from an economic standpoint, although the overall GDP numbers, as John pointed out, are, you know, not as good as we'd like to see. Right now, at least, corporate America seems to be making money. And I think right now, from this perspective, that will continue into the future. So I'm not really, as I said, looking for any particular correction any time, but at some point we're probably going to get something. But right now I think remain, let's say, cautiously optimistic.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Jeff, let's go ahead and wrap it up. Month of July, interest rates, very little change. So I don't know that there's much to talk about in regards to interest rates in July, but the Fed did meet on July 26th, and as expected, they left rates unchanged, but they tipped their hand a little bit about the balance sheet. So maybe a couple comments, if you could, about the Fed meeting, and then maybe a little tease, because I think it'll be something that we'll be talking about in the next couple months.
Well, that's right. There has been a sea change at the Fed in that we're moving sort of into phase two of the withdrawal of a lot of this stimulus and accommodation at the Fed. Basically, what is taking place, you know, during the last 8 years, the Fed has bought about $2 trillion worth of securities, U.S. Treasuries and mortgage backs, in an effort to lower longer-term interest rates. In addition to lowering the Fed funds rate on the short end. So the Fed has signaled that the time is coming. Janet Yellen has done a good job of trying to telegraph the Fed's intentions, and the latest communique, if you will, has been that the Fed is ready to start reducing, they call it reducing the balance sheet, letting some of these securities that they own roll off, not necessarily going out and selling them, but not reinvesting them as they mature. So letting that balance sheet wind down, that's an important part of the Fed's preparation for having things in place when the next recession rolls around, so that they'll be able to offer the economy some support like they traditionally do. So rates have been very stable. Inflation expectations continue to be well below 2%. The Fed's in good shape with a 2% print on the economy this past quarter. They feel really good about going ahead and moving forward with disengaging from some of this accommodation. So we'll be talking about it more, you're right, Dave, as we go through the year, but it looks like the Fed is preparing to move back to normalcy as John Portwood talked about a little bit earlier.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. Next month's call will be on September 5th. Talk to you then. Thank you.